Welcome to Lehigh Valley Discourse. You're tuned to WDIY Allentown, listener-supported community public radio here in the Lehigh Valley. I'm John Pierce, your host this evening. And on the board is Ray Schwab. Ray, thank you for coming in and doing the technical work for us.
Anytime, John.
My guest this evening, Dr. Trigg Meeker, has lived in the Lehigh Valley for 57 years and counting. He was born on a farm in the Pottstown area. After his formative years there, he studied chemistry at Ursinus College, earning a BS with honors. From there, Trigg went south for more education, all the way to the University of Delaware, where he earned an MS and a PhD in physical chemistry. He worked for almost 30 years at Bell Telephone Laboratories here in the Lehigh Valley. He's a member of various technical societies, has won 3 technical awards through the years. Trigg has written 5 chapters in books and has given 24 talks based on his research. Dr. Meeker has been married to his wife, Joan, for almost 60 years and has 3 children, 2 daughters and a son. I have known Trigg Meeker for 40 years. He's one of the most interesting people I've known, Ray, and many tales to tell. And that's why I wanted to have him on as a guest on Lehigh Valley Discourse. Trigg, welcome to Eclectic South Bethlehem.
Thanks, John.
You've been here before, I take it. Not to WDIY, but to Eclectic South Bethlehem.
Yes.
The early years. Let's go way back, Trigg. As far as you can remember, you have some sort of interesting tales to tell, I think, about, is it South Central Pennsylvania?
It was Montgomery County.
The school years, you're growing up on a farm. Tell us a little bit about what that life was like.
School years, my first grade teacher was Mrs. Smale, first and second grade. I went to grade school in a 5-room building, not 1 room. There were 2 grades to a room. Third and fourth grade is kind of a mystery to me. All I know is I had trouble with math. In fifth grade, Mrs. Johnson. And why am I mentioning names? Because they had such an impact on me and made me into whatever happened. Next to my seat in fifth grade was an Encyclopedia Britannica, which I fell in love with. There were times when I gave up my recesses to read the encyclopedia, and it was just fascinating. My heroes were Buck Rogers, Jesus Christ, Green Lantern, The Shadow, Prince Valiant, and if everyone had points that I was interested in.
Would you say you were a nerd?
Probably.
Turned out
it would be hard to contest that.
Giving up recess for the encyclopedia, that's the first I've heard that, Trigg.
When we played Cowboys and Indians, I was the secretary.
You kept notes.
I kept notes because I was a runt. I was very small. And so I wasn't big enough to be a cowboy or an Indian.
And what about farm life?
We did not live on a farm. My father was a welder at Bethlehem Steel, but we had a big truck patch, and we raised a lot of our own food. But I worked on the farms in the area. I learned how to throw bales of hay. I learned how to cut weeds. I learned how to sweat.
And that was in the Pottstown area.
And that was in the Boyertown Pottstown area, in Upper Potts Grove.
All right, what about indoor plumbing, electricity, and all those things?
My uncle was a master plumber, and I spent a whole summer as an apprentice to a master plumber. I learned how to solder pipes. I learned how to pack sewer pipes. I learned how to put tin roofs on and whatever. So it was good training. It was enough to drive me away from wanting to be a plumber.
And you mentioned the encyclopedia. How about chemistry sets? When did they come
somewhere,
into your life?
Somewhere along the line, probably when I was maybe 8 years old or thereabouts, somebody gave me a very small chemistry set with about six experiments, which was pretty exciting. And then I got a bigger one, a much bigger one, with about 40 experiments. And then it really got exciting. I started trying to build a rocket. And so I had to learn how to make black powder. And I could never make the black powder work right. So what I had to do was make it myself. And it turned out fuses were a very difficult problem. So I invented an electric fuse, which is now commonly used for detonating explosives. But I didn't file for the patent, so. But I was using that.
You invented that. Yeah.
That came in handy later. I did build a 5-pound rocket, which actually left the pad, but it blew up and burned a 5-foot radius of my mother's lawn. So.
You were in the doghouse with her for a while, right?
She was pretty forgiving.
We're chatting this evening with Dr. Trigg Meeker, who's telling about a really fascinating life. Ray, would you give the listeners the phone number to call?
If you have any questions, you can call 610-758-8810. Once again, that number is 610-758-8810 if you have any questions.
Trigg Meeker, you've put down here in our notes that spelling and sentence diagrams came into your life at some point. They were important to you.
It started in sixth grade, and then went in seventh and eighth grade. I had Mrs. DeVincentis, and she taught me how to diagram sentences. And then a little later, Miriam Ludwig in high school consolidated that into what she called precis. And we had to take newspaper articles and condense them down into paragraphs. And we had to do endless arrays of those. And so I learned how to shrink the visible part of an idea into as few words as possible.
Did that come into play later on in your professional life as a scientist?
Yes. I was an engineer that could actually write better than most. And in fact, the company asked me to teach a one-year course called Put It in Writing, which was the how engineers should learn how to write.
And it all goes back to grade school.
And it all goes back to grade school.
Great. That's good news for teachers out there, because teachers very often never hear afterwards from their former students and what impact they've had in their lives. That's another aspect of Dr. Meeker's life that we are just touching on, and that is as a teacher. So you were put in charge of a course to teach to other engineers, and were you already out in the professional world by that time?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. I had already written several memoranda.
What about high school glee club? Let's talk about that.
Well, it was kind of funny. The high school didn't have room for our study period. So we were doing our study period in the theater part, in the seats for the theater part of the high school. And one day we were horsing around, shooting caps and various other things. Study was something we did later. But the next thing you know, Peggy Reed came in. And Peggy Reed was the head of the glee club. And she said, "I need some volunteers. Everybody stand up." And so I became a member of the glee club.
Gotta like her way to get volunteers.
Now, my mother had already tried to teach me how to play the piano, which failed, but I did know how to read music. And so I had a good time. It's one of those things where you would not volunteer directly, but if somebody put the pressure on, you just can't say no.
Did you sing bass or tenor?
I was a tenor.
Tenor. Hmm? We need good tenors in these groups.
Yeah.
Have you ever watched the television show Glee?
No.
All right. Well, that's about a Glee club anyway. You also had an interest in Latin in high school.
I had a couple of years' worth of Latin. Latin was a very interesting language because the structure is different than English. It taught us that structure mattered, but it turns out that we understood fully why the Romans had so much trouble because nobody could figure out how to multiply a V times a V.
Exactly. So Latin taught you the importance of structure.
In language.
Haven't ever thought about that before, yes. And perhaps in other ways, in your scientific pursuits. Who knows, maybe that was an influence. So there was Glee Club, there was Latin, and then you have some names here, like Reed, Ludwig, Senseneg.
Okay. Miriam Ludwig was my English teacher and history teacher, which were not my favorite subjects. Willie Senseneg was my physics teacher. And my chemistry teacher, I don't remember too much about him. I remember what he looked like, but I don't remember his name. The problem was that my folks had let me build a lab in the basement of our house. And by the time I got to senior high, I had done all of the experiments in high school chemistry. And so it was kind of boring. But Willie Senseneg was teaching me physics, and he taught me about how a carburetor works in a car. I found a camera in the dump that I didn't understand the symbols on the camera. There was a Z, for example. I took the camera into him, and he said, "Oh, that's German. Z stands for Zeit." So that was a German camera. He said, "Why don't we check it and see if the bellows leak light?" So we darkened the room. I stayed after class, and we darkened the room, and the bellows were tight. There were no leaks. So he said, "Well, okay, let's test it. Let's test the optics." So he said, "Get some sheets of glass, the following size, and some carborundum and some oil, and rub them together until you frosted the glass. And we rubber band that frosted glass behind where the film would be in a camera and looked out the window. And we could see a beautiful colored picture of the trees and whatever." And so then I bought some film. And getting the pictures developed was a problem because it cost a lot of money, which I didn't have. So I set up a dark room and developed my own pictures. And
Where did you set up the dark room?
It was in a closet in my bedroom. And it had to be dark. So that was an interesting find, and I learned a lot about optics from Willie Senseneg.
Right, and not in class in that particular case.
Well, but it turns out that he had us do some thesis work on engines. We actually analyzed and discussed how 10 different engines work. And I had to write a report on that. And it was so much fun learning about those kind of things.
Have you saved any of those reports from the early days?
I don't know, but I think so.
Uh-huh. Yeah, great memories. Did you mention a teacher named Ludwig?
Miriam Ludwig was my history teacher.
Okay.
And my English teacher. And she's the one that had the history class. The office didn't know me very well. And they didn't know whether I was a boy or a girl. And so I had a full schedule, and I went running down to my gym class, and when I opened the door, the gym was full of screaming little girls. And that didn't seem appropriate. So I dashed up to the principal's office, and I said, there's been a terrible mistake. And he said, oh, no, there isn't. Come with me. So he went down, and he went into the screaming little girls. And he said, well, you're right. He said, you can't take Jim with the girls. So then he said, but your schedule is full, so the only thing you can do is to trade courses. So I had to take history with the girls. Now, Miriam Ludwig was my history teacher. Now, in order to get an A, it was necessary to give a 20-minute lecture every Friday on some historical subject. And the girls found out that I was shy and that I blushed, and so they tortured me.
They bullied you.
You might say that.
Poor Trig. It's ready. It's time to take a break now, Ray. So let us depart for just a minute, and we will be right back with Lehigh Valley Discourse.
Celtic Fair, a celebration of Celtic music and culture, from its roots in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, Galicia, and Brittany, to its branches in Australia, Cape Breton, Canada, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, and the Lehigh Valley. Bringing you music, interviews, and a weekly culture calendar every Thursday from 7 to 9 on WDIY Allentown listener-supported community public radio.
The time is 6:21, and you're tuned to WDIY Allentown, where definitely it's you. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm your host, John Pierce, chatting this evening with Dr. Trig Meeker about his very interesting life. Ray, what's the telephone number for our listeners to call?
If you have any questions for Dr. Meeker, you could give us a call in the studio at 610-758-8810. Again, if you have any questions for Dr. Meeker, give us a call at 610-758-8810.
Trig, your first name presents problems for most people to spell. How is it spelled?
T-H-R-Y-G-V-E.
And we pronounce it Trig.
Yes, that's because the H is silent, and it needs a vowel.
What's the ethnicity of the name?
My grandmother was a Norse woman. She came to this country when she was around 14 years old. She had a brother, Trygvi, who was named after a king of Norway in 600 B.C. And so my father was Trygvi Herman, and I was Trygvi Richard. The Richard came from Shakespeare because my mother was a school teacher. And she loved Shakespeare. So that was the Richard. And my son is Trygvi Kenneth, because Kenneth was my wife's father's name.
Interesting. So you use the middle names
to be different to distinguish them, rather than junior. 1, 2, 3. Mm-hmm.
When you were in high school, I think you were first in class. What does that mean?
Well, since we only had 8 grades out in the country in Upper Pottsgrove, When it was time for ninth grade, I had to enter the Pottstown school system. And so I went to ninth grade in Pottstown High, junior high. At that time, the leading class person was Hannah Schorsch. Her father was a Jewish rabbi, and she was the queen of the class. She had the best grades, best marks, and whatever. When the smoke cleared 3 years later, I was the valedictorian and she was the salutatorian. And Miriam Ludwig helped me write my 20-minute lecture that I had to give and practice it and rehearse it and enunciate everything clearly. And she was in the prompter's box. And when I gave the speech, I skipped a paragraph and lost her. And I did the second half of the speech from memory without a prompter. And I tried to do it with one breath, and it got very painful. But my classmates were crying when it was over. It was so, they felt so sorry for me.
Wow. What an experience. Trigg, what year did you graduate from high school?
1947.
We have history, English, math, physics. Did we cover those already?
I think so. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to skip ahead now with your graduation from high school. And what happened right after high school? Did you go right on to college?
Well, it turns out in December of my senior year, I got drafted. So I went down to Philadelphia to the Armory and passed my physical, got my notice to report. But my draft board said, look, you only have 3 months to go. Why don't we give you a short deferment? And so you can graduate from high school and get that over with and then serve your time. So I was planning to go to college. Now, why? Why college? Well, I wanted to be a pilot. I wanted to fly airplanes. And you had to have a college degree. Turned out my eyes weren't good enough to become a pilot. So that had to go later, but I didn't know that then. So, but in March of that year, they canceled the draft. My college plans had not been made. So Miriam Ludwig said, well, I'm a graduate of Ursinus College. I can't get you into a dorm, but I think I can get you enrolled if you don't mind being a day student. That was only 20 miles each way. So I said, okay. This sounds good to get started. And so I matriculated at Ursinus College. So she was responsible for getting me in. She wrote a very good report on my ability to study things I didn't like and whatever.
So many influences from your teachers from the
Absolutely.
Grade school and high school. You went on to Ursinus then, and you have your Bachelor of Science degree in chemistry.
That's correct.
And then was it immediately after that you went to graduate school?
Yes. Yes, I was on a fast track to the University of Delaware.
And tell us a little bit about names like Mosher and Beechel and Smith and Nelson.
There's another one in there, too, that I added later. That's Lynch, but that's in my copy, not yours. Bill Mosher was the head of the chemistry department at the University of Delaware. And Bill believed that his responsibility was to keep my draft board informed about my status as a scientist. And he actually went to draft board meetings and told them that they really needed me in graduate school. And so my deferment continued. He found lots of different jobs for me, not all of which were chemical. For example, I was a house father in Brown Hall, second floor. And I learned how to listen to people, students that had problems. Delaware had a very interesting program in those days. The first couple of days was spent in testing. They developed an educational profile for every student for their entire career at Delaware. And then they measured against that profile. And if they slipped, then the house father would get a call. You have six students on your floor that need attention. Talk to them. Don't try to fix it. You're not skilled enough in that. So I had to go to school to learn to be a psychoanalyst. So I had took courses in that. Usually the student had some kind of a problem at home, a father laid off, a death in the family, a girlfriend that left them, something like that. And all they needed to do was to talk to somebody about it. And we saved an awful lot of students. So it was a very good program.
And what a learning experience for you, too, to be a good listener.
And that came very useful later. Another job that he found for me was Dave Nelson was a young football coach. he had good quarterbacks that couldn't play because they couldn't get good grades. The average grade of the football team was a D, and so he had players that couldn't play. So he asked me to join the team, live in the training house, and bring a grade point average of the football team up. Now, I had a budget. I could hire a tutor if we needed it. I formed a committee of the captains and the quarterbacks, and I said, you keep order. We're going to study from 6 to 8 every night. No more punching holes in the walls. No more jumping out of second-story windows. No more horsing around. We're going to study. And at the end of the year, we had a C-plus average. And then I held it for another year, and Dave Nelson became an award-winning coach for a middle-sized university, and I helped.
Interesting.
Bill also found a lot of very neat projects for us to work on, and some of them were very exciting.
What were some of those projects?
Well, one particular one was the destruction of minefields that were used to guard beaches. And it turns out that the Navy had developed a technique using thermite, which is a burning mixture, to melt a hole in the mine, and then they steamed out the TNT and left the mine floating, but now harmless. And the enemy pretty soon figured out a good way to solve that was to make the wall thickness of the mine bigger, thicker, so that the thermite couldn't get its way through. So what they wanted was a super thermite, something that would be designed to work underwater, that would burn a hole through 2 to 3 inches of steel. And they had been working at it on several research labs in the country, the industrial corporations, and they were making no headway. So we accepted that job, and we approached it theoretically first. We did the theory, picked out a couple of candidates, and then started doing experiments. Our experiments were so spectacular that Bill Mosher put a picture window in our lab and put stadium seats outside. So and then we had to schedule our experiments when he had guests.
Wow.
Well, we finally ended up with three bombs 3 months later on a one-year contract. And that's where I used my electric fuse.
Now, you had the contract from whom?
That was from the Marines, from the U.S. Marines.
That's pretty exciting for a graduate student.
Rather. Yeah. So anyway, we made the three bombs, and they wanted us to demonstrate the three bombs. So I loaded the three bombs in the back of my car and headed for the Marine base on the Potomac on the other side of Washington. Well, I got lost in Washington, and I'm roaming through the city trying to find my way out with three bombs in the back of my car. I finally made it to the gate, and there was a big sergeant there with a great big gun. What are you doing here? I said, I'm here to test some bombs. So he called down to headquarters, and headquarters said, oh, the guy that was supposed to entertain him took the day off by accident. So he said, he's not here, but you go ahead down, they'll find somebody to help you. So I went down, and they found a lieutenant to manage the test, and he grabbed a seal, and we waded out into the Potomac with some bricks, and when we got to about 4 feet of water, we put some bricks down, put a plate of steel about 3.5 inches thick on top of the bricks, and we set one of my bombs on there and gave the push-button key to the seal. And the seal's standing right next to the plate, and I said, you know, this is different from what you're used to. He said, listen here, Sonny. He said, I've been in three wars. I ain't afraid of nothing. And then he pushed the button, and there was a whoosh, and there was a big hole in the steel. And the second two, he stood back a little bit. And so then they decided that was enough demonstration, so they told us to keep quiet for 17 years. They took our notebooks, and classified them above our secret clearance, and came and squashed the lab, and that was it. Now, we had a little bit left of this stuff that we had made. So we put it in a bottle. We didn't know what to do with it. So we put it in a bottle, and we labeled it super thermite. Well, the following year, Bill Mosher, every year, Bill Mosher did a test, a lecture for the incoming chemistry students. And he did a thermite test because it's spectacular. You have this red-hot iron comes out of this flower pot, and it goes into a bucket of sand and water. And there's a lot of steam and whatever, but no damage. Well, his lab assistant couldn't find the thermite, but he saw this bottle of super thermite. Well, that ought to do. So he put this flower pot full of this stuff on the thing, and Bill Mosher lit it, and it burnt right through the granite tabletop, went down through the lab bench, went through 12 inches of cement, and came out down below in the room below. Bill said after that, he said, I really never really fully understood what you guys had done. Anyway, it was 3 months, so then they said, look, it was a one-year contract. Why don't you just play around for the rest of the year? And that was it. So in 3 months, we did what nobody else was able to do in 5 years.
Wow, how impressive is that? Graduate students at the University of Delaware. Getting lost in Washington, D.C., yes, it's easy to do. And the adventures of bomb making, you call that, huh? Now, Trigg, you mentioned that in early years you were not really enamored of mathematics. And yet, later on, you had to take advanced mathematics for the work that you were going to do. How did you turn around your mind? We have some young people out there who are not too interested in math. How did you?
Well, it made a lot of sense as I continued that. But it turns out when I got to Ursinus, I wanted to minor in math, in German, and physics, along with my chemistry. Turned out Roger Steger needed some research done, and he hired me to do research for my tuition. And I did research in Wernicke coordination compounds, which are great big molecules, and I did the colorimetry studies of their colors and learned how to say their names, which was they were very big names. But it turns out that my mentor forgot to tell me that it would be better if I took geometry before I took calculus, advanced calculus. And I didn't. They signed me up for calculus first. So I flunked the first test, and I flunked every test after that. And while I was studying for the final, it suddenly became very clear. And when I went into the final, it was 11 questions, do any 10. I did all 11. I recognized the question, the root to the answer, and the answer for all 11. And I just wrote them down. I finished a three-hour test.
This was at what stage of your education?
I was a sophomore.
At Ursinus?
At Ursinus College. Okay.
And suddenly the light bulb went on, and you don't know why.
I have no idea why. All of a sudden, it just made perfect sense. And after that, I went on a binge, and I made made perfect scores on all tests, including finals, for a year and a half.
What a story. We have a caller. Would you say your first name and where you're calling from, please?
Hi, my name is Ahmed. I'm calling from Allentown.
Ahmed from Allentown. Welcome, sir. What would you like to say?
I used to work in Bell Labs in New Jersey, and I want to say hi to Mr. Trigg Meeker. I visited him in Allentown a few times, and he was just a great person. He is a great person.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Trigg, I used to work for Jack Cypress in SL.
Yes.
82, 83, I was the project manager, and I used to come and bother you a lot in Allentown.
I remember.
Very nice to hear your voice.
It's good to hear you, hear your voice.
Yeah. I have moved to Allentown now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Trig also lives in Allentown, so maybe there's a chance to get together. Anyway, it's nice to reminisce.
Yeah.
Thank you for the call, Ahmed.
Okay. Mr. Pierce, is it possible to send you an email?
Sure.
Okay, I will do that after. I will follow the program, and then I'll send you an email. Maybe we can stay in touch.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. All right. Well, I already knew that you were a very kind person, Trig, and one of the pleasures of having you on the program today, and compassionate, and you've talked about how you, one of the ways that you learn to be a good listener, and you certainly are that, and have proven to be a leader through the years by being a supervisor at Bell Labs. We'll get into that maybe a little bit later. And it's nice to hear from a former colleague.
Yes, it is.
We're going to take a break now, and we will be back in 60 seconds with more of Lehigh Valley Discourse.
For program support on WDIY, we thank the Easton Main Street Initiative, offering free concert series this year. Live in the Square will run on the last Friday of every month through September in Easton Center Square. Friday, August 31st, The Billies, Low Country Groove from Lancaster. For weather cancellations, eastonmainstreet.org or on Facebook.
Here we are back with Lehigh Valley Discourse, chatting this evening with Dr. Trig Meeker, whose life has taken many turns, and he's originally a Pennsylvanian who dipped into the waters of Delaware for a while and then decided to come back to Pennsylvania. Did you have other states in there in the meantime, Trig,
no.
Where you lived? No, it was Pennsylvania, Delaware, Pennsylvania.
No, it was New Jersey.
New Jersey also.
I worked at Bell Labs in Whippany, New Jersey for 6 years.
We've talked about super thermite for military use, and it's on to quantum mechanics.
You know, one of the things that really interested me was how come things had color. What was there about things that caused the light to separate into its colors? And the work I did on vertical coordination compounds, I was able to tailor molecules to get whatever color I wanted. But if it's still just a size effect, then whatever. But I do remember Ursinus was a member of the Eastern College's small science conference, which was a group of small colleges, but Yale was actually one of them, and that was not that small. And we went to Yale to a conference, and I went to the Yale bookstore, and I found a book on quantum mechanics by Dyatkina, a Russian scientist. And it was intriguing, because here was a mathematical technique that explained the spectroscopy of molecules and atoms pretty well. And so I was fascinated by that. My first advisor at Delaware was Dr. Cecil Lynch, and I did a thesis on using an electrode to oxidize cinnamaldehyde to cinnamic acid, which showed how important the electrons were in this reaction. But listed on the course curriculum, there was a course called quantum mechanics. So a couple of us asked Dr. Lynch if he would teach that course, and he said, "You don't want to." So we said, "Yes, we do." He said, "Well, I'll tell you what, I'll give you 10 free lectures now, and if you still want to after that, we'll do a year." Well, we survived the 10 lectures and went on to the year. Well, it turns out he had never had a course in quantum mechanics, so he basically took a textbook and read it to us. But then Dr. Smith came along, and now he was full of quantum stuff. And so we had a book that we used in a course, and it was written by an author, Rojansky, called Quantum Mechanics Problems. And I remember very clearly one of the problems that we learned how to do. We calculated the radius of the rubidium ion from first principles. We knew how to take every element in every atom in the periodic table and calculate its spectra. And that seemed like such a good idea. And there were two different ways of treating quantum mechanics. One was the Heisenberg method, and the other one was the Schrödinger method. And when it got to molecules, the Schrödinger method got pretty complicated. But the Heisenberg method was done with matrices. And so Bill Wilson and I, decided to try it out. And we calculated the wave functions from the lower order molecules in a homologous series. And then we used the numbers that we got to calculate the properties of the higher order. And the fit was outstanding. So quantum mechanics works. So when I started working in Allentown, I asked the management if they would let me teach a course at Lehigh University in quantum chemistry, in quantum mechanics for chemists, and I did that. And we solved a very interesting problem. It turns out if you put an electron in a test tube, it will cling to the wall of the test tube. So we know that's true. The question is why? Why doesn't it just roam around inside? So what we did, we made a one-dimensional test tube, and we solved the Schrödinger wave equation for an electron in a one-dimensional test tube, and lo and behold, it clings to the wall. Now, so it was strictly an energy problem. It's strictly a quantum effect. And it turns out that lots of people had tried to explain it with image forces and all kinds of complications, which were totally unnecessary. The solution lay in the quantum properties of the system. Now the physicist that took the course at Lehigh said it was too easy, and the chemist said it was too hard, so I was right in the middle, which is probably where I should have been.
Where you should have been. We're chatting here on Lehigh Valley Discourse with Dr. Trigg Meeker, and we are taking phone calls, Ray.
The lines are open, and if you have any questions for Dr. Meeker, you can give us a call at 610-758-8810. We enjoyed our call from Ahmed. Hopefully we'll get some more.
We want to touch on the topic of electrical engineering, Trigg, which we haven't done
yet. Well, it turns out Bill Mosher came in one day, and he said, next week there's some tests here at the university, and I think you ought to take them. Now, I never argued with Bill. If he thought I should do something, I did it. And so I took the tests. It was 3 days worth of testing. The National Science Foundation had decided that they wanted to broaden some graduate students. And so they budgeted 500 scholarships for the country. And these tests were to determine which 500 graduate students in the United States got a scholarship. And I got one. One of the conditions of that scholarship, first of all, I got a raise. I got more money than my present apprenticeship was worth. But one of the conditions was I had to change my major at the graduate level for 1 year. And since Dr. Smith was now on board, looking for graduate students, I thought this would be a great opportunity to do some physics, and while I was at it, some electrical engineering and some advanced math. And so I took that year off. That added a year to my program there. But I took quantum mechanics and spectroscopy, and I read Einstein's original papers in the German.
Wow.
And so we took the course in quantum mechanics problems, and also worked on the spectrometer for the nuclear magnetic resonance and whatever. we came very close to inventing the laser. We just had one little key step that we couldn't seem to figure out. And in 1955, that happened somewhere else. But we almost invented the laser. And but that was an exciting year. And it was just full of excitement.
Right. Trig, when I was an undergraduate and taking science courses for non-science majors, there was a book that we were to read, which was, I think it was entitled The Origin of the Universe, written by George Gamow. You have actually met him.
Yes, I have.
Tell us about that.
Well, Bill Mosher signed me up for the head of the chemistry department social club. He felt I needed a leadership role, so. And so we had a small committee that organized the events for this group of graduate students. There were about 30 altogether. So we heard about George Gamow, and we heard that I think he was a professor at Cornell or Colgate, and he was spending a lot of time in Washington, and he traveled by train from Washington to Philadelphia and then from Philadelphia to New York State. And so we said, well, maybe he would stop in and give us a lecture on cosmology. So I got in touch with him, probably by mail, because we didn't have email. Telephone was even hard, so, but I think I probably did it by mail. And he said, oh, I'd be delighted. So one afternoon, he got off the B&O Railroad runs right through the university, and the train stopped, and out comes George Gamow. And I met him, two of us met him for lunch. He gave us a problem to work on during lunch. He said he liked to encourage his students to think. And his problem was, how come a mirror turns you from right to left and not from top to bottom?
Love it.
And then he gave us a wonderful lecture. We took him to supper. So I bought him two meals with my budget. And he gave us a wonderful talk on cosmology.
And here's a giant in his field, one of the very top.
And the audience asked him lots of questions. And we had a really good time. And around 11 o'clock, I put him back on the train. It stopped and picked him up and took him on his way. And whatever.
What a neat contact to have for you as a graduate student. Trig, I'm intrigued here that you have mentioned the football team as one of the topics.
Well, that was my experience with Dave Nelson.
All right, that was back that we already talked about.
Yeah.
How about the importance of DuPont, in Delaware?
Well, DuPont was actually financing almost everything in sight. For example, during my 5 years in Newark, I had a local bank checking account. That checking account, the fees were all paid by DuPont. DuPont ran the state. And the university budget was something like 80% DuPont money.
Wow.
Last year it was 9%, so it's changed quite a lot. But I was also a DuPont fellow. I had a pass to the experimental station. I used the library frequently. I actually got job offers from DuPont when I graduated, but Bell Labs' offer was better.
So right after graduation then from the University of Delaware with your PhD, you went to work for Bell Labs?
At Whippany in the military division.
And that lasted for?
6 years.
And then on to where?
And then on to Union Boulevard in Allentown.
And that was for longer?
And I was for the rest of my 31 years.
Right. So most of those years spent right here in the Lehigh Valley. And we heard from one of your former colleagues, Ahmed from Allentown, earlier. That was pleasant. What would you like to tell us about the years in Allentown, Union Boulevard?
Probably the biggest thing that happened, I started out with some research on ferroelectrics. And these were advanced switchers in memory. And it turns out there were some problems. The research department had gotten all the credit they wanted for inventing it, but it didn't work very well. And so I was finishing up. My management said I was PhDing on them quite often when I gave my reports. But it turns out that a problem arose at the end of World War II. And the problem had to do with radars. It was pretty clear from the English experience that the current radars would not take care of rockets. Planes, fine, but they didn't have the range and they didn't have the resolution. So they needed a better radar, one that had much greater range. And they jacked up the power that they put on the antenna until the antennas arced. But after that, they weren't very good antennas because they were shorted by the lightning between them. So there was a limit to what the range could be. So some theoreticians had figured out that if you had a dispersive device, you could do it. Now, dispersion was an enemy. FM designers, radio designers, know that dispersion causes static and bad reception. And so here they wanted controlled dispersion, and the electrical engineers were kind of worthless. So there were all kinds of crazy ideas. But one of the department heads in our group said, "I know. I came across a dispersive mode of transmission in a wire. And if we could make a delay line out of that, we could give them all the dispersion that they needed." So he started making some wire. They were called Pockhammer free modes. Well, he had trouble making it. This wire was 50 mils in diameter. It had little barrels, and they were 8 feet long. Had little barrels of ceramic to serve as transducers that were 50 mils thick and 35 mils in diameter. That's pretty tiny. And he was having trouble fastening them together. So they finally decided that he needed help. And what kind of help did he need? Well, they needed somebody that could plate copper onto aluminum. They thought of me. So they asked me if I would give him a hand and drop what I was doing. So I started out. I started out by by copper plating the aluminum, which turned out to be quite a chore. And I finally got that working. And then I put a good metal on the ceramic. And then we used a low temperature solder to solder the pieces together. I used a spinning sand brush to shape the transducers, and I assembled some very closely tight tolerance wires. As I improved the construction techniques, the yield went down until finally they were all bad, but they were perfect. So obviously we're getting better and better at making the wrong thing. So I said, "Look," to my boss, I said, "look, we've got to change something." And he said, "Oh, no, we can't change anything. It's too late." And I finally convinced him that we ought to try a strip. The seventh strip that he left me make was better than the best wire we ever made. And that's the one that we used in 1967 to shoot down an ICBM for the very first time. That was the beginning of the end of the Cold War, because Russia couldn't jam it.
And your entire career that you've worked was during the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
And then you retired from Bell Labs in what year?
In 1986.
Right, and then did some consulting after that,
mm-hmm.
and now are completely retired.
Pretty much.
Right. Dr. Trigg Meeker has been our guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse. Trigg, I want to thank you so much for coming to Eclectic South Bethlehem to be with us.
You're welcome.
What an interesting life. Hope you can join us again on Lehigh Valley Discourse every Thursday here on WDIY Allentown, 6 to 7 p.m. Ray Schwab, thank you very much for working the board for us.
Of course. It was my pleasure.
We'll see you next time.
You're listening to WDIY in Allentown, 88.1 FM and HD, listener-supported community public radio. That's WDIY at 88.1 FM in Allentown and Bethlehem, and on translators 93.9 in Easton and Phillipsburg, 93.7 in Fogelsville and Trexlertown, and on the World Wide Web at WDIY.org. The current time is 7 o'clock. Current weather conditions in the Lehigh Valley, it's 83 degrees. Tonight will be mostly clear with a low of around 60. Tomorrow will be sunny, a high of 89, and tomorrow night will be partly cloudy, a low of 62. Stay tuned for Celtic Fair, but first, today's news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Mitt Romney today made a case for the energy plan he'll push if he is elected. As NPR's Richard Harris explains, it focuses mostly on drilling for more oil.
Support for NPR comes from the George Lucas